This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 140, Meet the Neighbors Who Resisted. Last time, we finished off the reign of King Seleucus I Nicator, Seleucus the Victor, and how he nearly reunited the bulk of Alexander the Great's empire. Seleucus spent the 280s mopping up in Anatolia. He defeated and captured Demetrius Polyocrates, who died in captivity. He faced Lysimachus on the battlefield and killed the king in Thrace. Through a series of succession crises, the Antipatrid dynasty was wiped out, and Lysimachus also delivered Macedon into Seleucid hands. But only for a moment, before Ptolemy Keraunos betrayed and murdered Seleucus shortly after they returned to Europe. Many of the Diadochoi dynasties were just wiped out. Of those that remained, two were Ptolemies, and most of the rest was Seleucid. Antigonus Gonatas was still out there, as was Pyrrhus of Epirus, but we're going to save that for next time. Today, we are talking about the other Diadochoi. Those kings who didn't come from Macedon with Alexander the Great. These are the kings and kingdoms who were just as much direct successors to the Achaemenids as they were to Alexander. These are the various states and political powers that rose out of the ashes of ancient Persia, without submitting directly or consistently to Macedonian rule. In most cases, we know very little about these minor powers in the early Hellenistic period. Some of them will rise to greater prominence over time. Others will collapse before the Greek-dominated historical record could get to them. At least one will remain important as an independent state just outside the bounds of recorded history for centuries to come. Let's start in the northeast, with the Dahae. This was a group of Saka, or at least partially Saka, who were nomads living in the steppe around the eastern Caspian and Aral Seas. They have also been with us in some capacity since at least Xerxes I, some 300 years ago in terms of narrative. Historians have tried to link the Dahae Confederacy that emerged in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE to various other references from the Avesta, where the Daha are a distinct people separate from the Zoroastrian Arya, similar to the semi-mythical Turanians, or to Herodotus, where the Da'oi are presented as one of the Persian tribes in Cyrus the Great's day. Attempts have been made to connect them with Chinese and Indian sources. They have been linked to basically every Sakha group ever referenced by name in the Central Steppe. And the simple reality to all of these connections is that historians are just speculating. There are a number of old Iranian words with a Da stem that could be the root for Dahai, and each one presents its own possibilities. Not to mention the wide range of other language families that could have lent the Dahai their name, ranging from Slavic to Uralic to Turkic. By the turn of the 3rd century BCE, we know that the Dahai were a dominant force in the Caspian Aral Basin. But by the time we can say that with certainty, the powerful steppe confederacy was either fracturing or spreading further than its leaders could actually exert control. Around our current point in the narrative, the Roman geographer Strabo suggests that at least 3 tribes from the Dahai began spreading into the Seleucid upper satrapies. 2 groups, called the Xanthioi and the Pisoroi, spread far to the east, raiding through Margiana and Aria in search of new lands to graze their livestock and exact tribute. These actually may have been the steppe invaders that Co-King Antiochus fought in episode 137 during his time in Bactria. Another Dahai tribe, the Parni, also called Sparni or Operni, further south through the Kopet Dag Mountains and into Seleucid Hyrcania, eventually taking up residence along the River Okis. Though Antiochus may have exacted some tribute from his military campaigns against these invaders, the Dahai and their wayward tribes were no longer vassals to any settled society as Xerxes claimed 300 years earlier. Instead, they were a separate layer of society that existed alongside the Seleucids, exacting tribute and tolls or just committing banditry from travelers and isolated settlements in the sparsely inhabited fringes of the steppe. Much of the Dahai's territory actually seems to have overlapped with another of today's successor states, Khwarazmia. It's not actually clear whether Khwarazmia, also known as Khwarazm, became an independent kingdom. This was a state, formerly an Achaemenid satrapy, in the fertile plains of the Oxus River Delta, south of the Aral Sea. The Khwarazmians appeared as subjects of Darius the Great in the very first Achaemenid territory list and reappear in every subsequent version down to Artaxerxes II. But even as bits of information pop in and out of history from their much more distant neighbors in places like Bactria and Aria, Khwarazmia is barely mentioned in any classical or Persian source. We know from geographic and personal names that they used some sort of Iranian language, and archaeology has shown that the oases and river delta region were organized around a centralized and heavily military state. We even know that they likely kept written records, a monarchy, and a mint, as Aramaic writing appears on their coinage, but no detailed sources have survived. Instead, we turn to the extensive archaeology carried out in modern Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan by Soviet scholars in the 20th century for more information. From that, we can make some inferences. Achaemenid influence is obvious enough in their art and architecture, with many structures and containers similar to those seen at Persepolis. They also appear to have remained plugged in to the ongoing cultural developments of the wider Iranian world, with enclosed temples similar to those found in southern Iran appearing at roughly the same time in the late Achaemenid and early Hellenistic periods. The Khwarazmians, like most Iranians of the time, practiced a form of Zoroastrianism, evident from their burial practices, with skeletonized remains either buried in clay pots for the lower classes, or entombed in more opulent ossuary pits. These same archaeological expeditions found evidence of massive fortifications at most late Achaemenid and early Hellenistic Khwarazmian sites, along with the remains of scaled armor and iron weapons. By the end of the 5th century, Khwarazmia already looks like it was largely independent of Achaemenid rule, and this is sometimes portrayed in the context of the Great Satrap's revolt against Artaxerxes II, but I think that is misleading. Khwarazmia's independence would have come at roughly the same time that the Dahai became a more imposing presence in the surrounding deserts and grasslands. For all intents and purposes, Khwarazmia was an isolated agricultural center surrounded by nomadic herders and raiders, which likely contributed to its fully independent status and relatively unimportant role in later state politics. Simultaneously, it's a relatively wealthy position that allowed Khwarazmia to become a local military power in order to fend off the Dahai and later nomadic threats. Crossing the Caspian Sea, we next run into Media Atropatene, more often called Media Atropatene. Previously, this was the satrapy of Media Minor, and more often than not, we'll just call it Atropatene. This is one of the Iranian successor states that we know the least about in this period, despite kind of being right in the center of the Seleucid Empire. After seizing control of Ecbatana, Alexander the Great made a compromise with Atropates, the last Achaemenid satrap of Media. He had supported Darius up to the very last minute, but he did surrender his lands to Macedon without a fight. So Alexander allowed Atropates to keep the northeastern fringe of his satrapy, roughly equivalent to modern Azerbaijan, both the independent country and the Iranian provinces of that name. This was an important border region and the site of several significant tribal revolts in the Achaemenid period, and a few Achaemenid palaces and forts were built there. So it wasn't like Atropates was starting a new satrapy from nothing in the mountains. Initially, he remained on very good terms with the Macedonians, and probably thought that he had a good position in the new order. During the mass wedding at Susa, one of Atropates' daughters married Perdiccas. And when Alexander died, Perdiccas's new position as regent was probably very comforting to the satrap of Media Minor. Then, Perdiccas went to war with all of the other Diadochoi at once and was assassinated in the process. Between the wars of Eumenes, Antigonus, and Seleucus, Atropates just withdrew from imperial politics and refused to swear allegiance to anyone. Instead, he just declared himself an independent king of Media, or as the Greek historians called it, Media Atropatene. Atropates Media. Over time, the association with Media was lost altogether, and Atropatene likely became the root word for the modern name of Azerbaijan. Atropates himself likely died sometime during the Wars of the Diadochoi, but we hear very little about his immediate successors or their activities. Atropatene was bordered to the west by two new kingdoms, Iberia in the north and Armenia in the south. We will loop back to Armenia later. So for now, let's cross into a region I've barely talked about on this podcast, the modern nation of Georgia. At this point, Georgia had two primary kingdoms or regions. Iberia, the inland region and most of the modern country, and the coastal territory of Colchis. Both regions at least paid tribute, sometime in the form of slaves, to the Achaemenids, and some Achaemenid-style forts were built throughout the southern Caucasus. But as a rule, we don't really know anything about what was happening in this area under Persian auspices. Xenophon and the 10,000 Greek mercenaries passed through southwestern Colchis briefly, but that's just about it. Conveniently for us, Georgia's semi-mythological history begins right around our current point in the narrative, with a suspiciously Iranian-sounding king named Pharnavaz I of Iberia. I won't belabor the story here. If you want more of those details, go listen to my friend Roberto explain them in great detail on the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia podcast, link down below. Suffice to say, Georgian history was only really recorded thoroughly much, much later, after Christianization, and the line between history, local legend, and Bible stories is extraordinarily blurred. According to Georgian tradition, Pharnavaz did have some sort of connection to the late Achaemenids as the son of a Persian noblewoman from Gabai, the Achaemenid palace complex near modern Isfahan, where Eumenes was eventually defeated. This was likely as some sort of marriage pact between his father and one of the later Achaemenid kings. The Georgian chronicles describe Iberia at this time as Aryan Kartli, further suggesting late Achaemenid oversight and the last descendant of the major Persian governors or vassal kings in the area was supposedly a ruler named Azan. According to the same tradition, Alexander the Great ordered Azan to worship five celestial gods representing the sun, moon, and stars, as well as an invisible creator deity. If you just swap Alexander out for a less impressive-sounding Artaxerxes, that sure sounds like there was some sort of conversion to Zoroastrianism underway, which would make sense. This can also be seen as a mythological explanation for why Georgian culture and myth is so different from many of their neighbors. Because Azan is ultimately defeated. Regardless, Azan is presented as a corrupt and cruel despot, prompting Pharnavaz into a revolt sometime around the turn of the 3rd century. He allied with a ruler named Kuji from the neighboring kingdom of Colchis on the eastern coast of the Black Sea, and together they fought a war to oust Azan and place Pharnavaz I on the Iberian throne. According to the Georgian chronicles, Kuji's sister married Pharnavaz and their two kingdoms were made into one. Pharnavaz went on to make a number of alliances in order to secure his independence and institute a centralized system that looks very similar to the Achaemenid imperial system of government on a more localized level. There were district military governors appointed by the king, similar to Persian satrapies. He then sent an emissary to King Antiochus with gifts. This wasn't submission as a Seleucid vassal, in part because Iberia was much too far away from Seleucid borders for that to make sense. But it was a request for recognition. Antiochus, then acting as his father's co-king, recognized Pharnabaz as an independent monarch, effectively ceding any old Achaemenid claim to the region. We know much less about coastal Colchis in this period. At least some of that region supposedly submitted to Pharnabaz and joined Iberia. But for the most part, the central eastern coast of the Black Sea was still a network of nomadic fortress peoples and city-states with very little documentation. Over the coming decades, Pharnabaz and his successors united most of the region with Iberia, but it does not appear to have been as immediate as later chronicles suggest. We are actually going to move north next, to a region we haven't touched on in almost 90 episodes. I think the last time that I mentioned the Cimmerian Bosporus and the Bosporan Kingdom was all the way back in episode 55. Which makes sense, since that's the last time it was at all relevant to our story. For those that don't remember a minor detail in episodes from 4 years ago, let's review. The Cimmerian Bosporus was the ancient name for the Kerch Strait between Russia and the Crimean Peninsula. In antiquity, some very enterprising Greeks settled along the coasts of the Black Sea, and many of those early foundations had ties to the Ionian city of Miletus in southwestern Anatolia. At least by proxy of Miletus, they came under Achaemenid influence early on, and there is archaeological evidence to suggest some of these cities in the Cimmerian Bosporus were actually involved in the Ionian revolt against Darius the Great. After Xerxes was defeated in Greece, a new king named Archaeanax seized control of all of the Greek cities along the strait. That's really the last time they were relevant in history of Persia, aside from their grain exports getting held up at the Byzantine Bosporus every time there was a war in Greece. Though it was composed of Greek cities, the Bosporan Kingdom was flanked by Thrace to the west and Scythian nomads to the north and east. A Thracian general, probably a mercenary, overthrew the Archaeonactid dynasty and installed himself as the Bosporan king in 438 BCE. His name was Spartacus. No, not that Spartacus. Spartacus's descendants set about the important business of expanding their kingdom, initially conquering the other Greek cities in the area, spreading out along the peninsulas on either side of the strait. By conquering along the coasts, they were able to exert control inland without much trouble in both peninsulae. The Spartacid kings also developed a novel system of government, jointly ruling with their sons or brothers as co-kings without much issue for decades, and even becoming strong enough to force several local Scythian groups into submission. In 309 BC, the succession fell to three brothers, who disagreed about their responsibilities. This promptly led to a Bosporan civil war, with one of the younger brothers named Eumelos winning sole power. Eumelos launched his kingdom into the ranks of the Diadochoi, sending ambassadors out to form treaties with the Ptolemies and Seleucids, and entering into an economic battle with Lysimachus, that led the king in Thrace to cut off Bosporan trade at the Hellespont. After Lysimachus and Eumelos were both dead, the Bosporan king Spartacus III and Antiochus I worked out a new deal to allow Bosporan grain to reach Greece once again. Southwest of the Cimmerian Bosporus was Odrysian Thrace. The Odrysian dynasty, like the Bosporan kingdom, emerged when the Achaemenids fled from Europe in the 470s. From relatively simple origins as a tribal confederacy to a full-fledged kingdom following the Achaemenid model, they have been in and out of our story for a while. They were involved in most of the same Greek wars as Persia for over a century, and the Odrysians were briefly conquered by Philip and Alexander in Macedon's Wars of Expansion. Right around the time of Alexander's death, the young Odrysian king Seuthes III rebelled and retook independence. He fought against Lysimachus's kingdom in southwestern Thrace for over 40 years. Neither side was ever really able to best the other, but Seuthes III took great steps to integrate his kingdom into the new Hellenistic order of things, arranging marriage pacts with the Macedonian nobles like his wife Berenike, and founding a capital city named after himself, Seuthopolis, in the style of the other Diadochoi. Despite his relative military success, Seuthes III's kingdom was constantly on the brink of hard times. They were never able to seize coastal territory from Lysimachus or the Spartacids, meaning that they were largely limited to the northeastern inland part of Thrace, and were constantly harassed by the neighboring Scythians just as much as the Macedonians were. They had neither the mines to mint their own silver and gold coinage, nor the export wealth to import precious metal, so their economic reach was quite limited. Sometime around the current point in our narrative, 280 BC, Seuthes III fell ill, and his wife, Queen Berenike, took control of the Odrysian kingdom, just in time for the ruler of a major Odrysian fort city called Kabule to rebel and declare himself king. The same inscription that tells us that Berenike took power also names four of Seuthes' sons, suggesting that they were all underage or otherwise incapable of ruling. If you don't have a single viable heir after 43 years on the throne, something has gone terribly wrong. Whether it was disease, bad luck, or constantly fighting with Lysimachus, the Odrysian succession plan was deeply damaged, and a rebellion did not help. It's not at all clear what happened next, and whether another Odrysian king even managed to take over is up for debate. Soon after Seuthes III died, his city, Seuthopolis, fell to an invasion, likely the Celtic Gauls, but that's getting ahead of ourselves. Suffice to say, Odrysian Thrace collapsed not long after their Lysimachid rival. Various rump states or distantly related successors popped up over the centuries, but the kingdom was gone for all intents and purposes. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. From there, we skip over the rest of Thrace, lately conquered by Seleucus and stolen by Ptolemy Keranos, down to another Bosporus. This Bosporus, which I'll call the Byzantine Bosporus, runs between Byzantion in Europe and Chalcedon in Asia. In other words, the western and eastern halves of modern Istanbul. Many of the Greek cities around the Black Sea, including Byzantion, were effectively independent at this time. But the Chalcedon side of the Byzantine Bosporus was actually home to another tiny kingdom. And oddly enough, it's our third Thracian dynasty of the episode. Given that the Bosporus is smaller than some rivers, it's no surprise that Thracians had long since crossed over from Europe to Asia and taken up residence in the area called Bithynia. During Alexander the Great's invasion, this was part of that northern stretch of Anatolia that was largely neglected by the great conqueror and his more famous generals. Instead, the Greek general Cullus was defeated in Bithynia by a Thracian governor for the Achaemenids named Bas. Bas managed to fend off the Macedonians from a small territory around the southwestern Sea of Marmara and the Chalcedon side of the Bosporus for years, as the Macedonians conquered most of the surrounding area. Bas died a few years before Alexander, but his son, Zipoites, succeeded him and declared Bithynia an independent kingdom. Zipoites successfully fended off attacks by the Diadochoi for the rest of his life, in part because Bithynia was just never a big enough issue for any of them to prioritize it. Zipoites did struggle to expand his territory, initially failing to conquer a few Greek cities due to Antigonid intervention, but after the Antigonids were defeated at Ipsus, he was more successful and destroyed the city of Astacus. Like many of the would-be successors of Alexander, Zipoites too founded a city, Zipoitia, in his own honor. He actually died a few years after Seleucus Nicator, but his son, Nicomedes, founded the city of Nicomedia on the ruins of Astacus. If a city called Nicomedia sounds familiar to you, especially in the context of early Christianity, this is that city. Nicomedes I of Bithynia will stick around in our story for another 20 years. East of Bithynia was Paphlagonia, a region that was kind of up in the air at this point. We last saw Paphlagonia when Xenophon and his army were marching through, discovering that the various city-states and local tribes still had great autonomy to defend their homeland and fight one another so long as they paid tribute to the Achaemenids. At this point, that status quo had not really changed. Nominally, the Paphlagonians submitted to Alexander, but since they were kinda stuck between a bunch of newly independent small kingdoms, they had fallen out of control from the Diadochoi as well. Without their own independent kingdom, the Paphlagonians and the Greek cities on their coasts were vulnerable to predation from their new neighbors, although some, like the Greek city of Sinope, held out as independent entities for most of the 3rd century. The disorganization of Paphlagonia and Bithynia was actually a major benefit to one young man and distant relative of the Achaemenid family, called Mithridates III of Chios. We've been encountering Mithridateses in the Greek city of Chios for a while. This was located in northwestern Bithynia, actually pretty close to the future site of Nicomedia. Under the Achaemenids, this was part of the satrapy of Hellespontine Phrygia and frequently entrusted to a branch of the Pharnacid family of satraps. Those are the ones who could trace their lineage all the way back to Hystaspes, the father of Darius the Great. Mithridates II of Chios first appeared in our narrative all the way back during the Great Satrap's Revolt when he helped recapture his own father, Ariobarzanes, and retake Hellespontine Phrygia for the king. Mithridates II was actually still around and well into his mid-80s by the time that Antigonus Monophthalmos was trying to consolidate power in Anatolia. When Antigonid forces conquered Chios, Mithridates II was executed and his son, also called Mithridates, fled into Paphlagonia. Mithridates III made his escape in part because he was actually good friends with Demetrius Polyocrates, who warned his buddy in advance. The younger Mithridates and his entourage held up in a fortress called Kimiata, and began gathering mercenaries and local supporters to help fend off the Diadochoi. Ultimately, Mithridates III of Chios would never return to his ancestral city. But as northern Anatolia was increasingly a no-man's land in the wars of Alexander's successors, new opportunities presented themselves. Mithridates seized the city of Amasia in northern Cappadocia as his new base of operations. If you remember back to the Great Satrap's Revolt, following the defeat of Datames, Cappadocia was split in two. Historians continue to call the south Cappadocia, but the north is known as Pontus, the Greek name for the Black Sea. Hypothetically, this region was ruled by Lysimachus after the Battle of Ipsus, but actual Lysimachid control was sparse. And when Lysimachus died, Mithridates declared himself king of Pontus. He was no longer the third of Chios, he was now Mithridates I, and his descendants would form one of the most important kingdoms of the Hellenistic era. Mithridates himself died shortly after fending off a half-hearted attack from Seleucus, but his son, Ariobarzanes, continued expanding, seizing the port city of Amastris a few years later, giving the kingdom of Pontus its first major port. Next we go south to Cappadocia, which followed an odd trajectory in the early Hellenistic period. Following the Great Satrap's Revolt, southern Cappadocia was given to Ariamnes as a reward for remaining loyal despite his father Datames, sparking the uprising. Diodorus Siculus offers a largely fictitious genealogy of later Cappadocian kings that is rightfully dismissed by most historians. But a discrepancy in that list helps explain Ariamnes' place in history. Ariamnes, the son of Datames, reigned for 50 years, 362 to 312, according to Diodorus. But Diodorus lists Ariathres as the next Cappadocian ruler and a son of Ariamnes. Except we know that Ariathres was A, the satrap of Achaemenid Pontus, and B, in charge already by the time Alexander invaded in 334. There is actually a very simple explanation here. This is one of several points in the Cappadocian Kings List where Diodorus just mashes family trees together. See, Ariamnes probably did rule southern Cappadocia for about 50 years, surviving long enough to see central authority in the region collapse following Alexander the Great's death. Meanwhile, his northern counterpart was Ariathres I. Ariathres loyally served Darius III against Alexander all the way up to the decisive battle at Gaugamela. Then he went home and continued to fight against Macedonian rule, whether it came from Alexander or Eumenes. Ariathres carved out a kingdom of his own in the middle of old Cappadocia, not reaching coastal Pontus, but slowly consolidating control in the south. He and his son, another Ariathres, were briefly chased out by Eumenes when he was in charge of Anatolia, but Ariathres II returned and retook his kingdom when Eumenes died. Seleucus briefly forced the Cappadocian kingdom to pay tribute, but Ariathres II passed his throne on to a son, this time named Ariamenes, around the time that Seleucus was murdered. Nominally, Cappadocia remained a Seleucid vassal for a few more years, but by the end of Ariamnes' life, it was recognized as an independent kingdom. East of Cappadocia and Pontus, we find the young kingdom of Armenia. Armenia and its dynasts are going to be very important to our story going forward, and I have been trying to keep them in the story for a while now. From Darius the Great's coup onward, the satrapy was ruled by the Hidarnids, a family of Persian nobles descended from one of Darius's 6 co-conspirators. After a rebellion against Darius II, the Hidarnids were replaced by their own distant cousins from Bactria, a branch of the family we call Orontids, after the satrap installed by Darius II named Orontes. The exact sequence of Persian rulers in Armenia after that is a bit difficult to understand. At some point after Orontes I, the future King of Kings Darius III was briefly given the Armenian satrapy, but when he left to become king, another Orontes was given that office. Based on a genealogy from a later branch of the family, this does seem to be the original Orontes' son. So Orontes II commanded Armenian troops against Alexander the Great in the Battle of Gaugamela. He then fled to Ecbatana with Darius and Atropates before returning to his home and fighting off the Macedonian conquest. Altogether, too much academic ink has been spilled over the last 1500 years to try and explain what came next. Different ancient sources provide different Macedonian appointees as satrap of Armenia, even over the course of Alexander's campaigns, and nothing is made easier to understand by the involvements of several Iranians who all have Mithra as part of their name. Different accounts suggest that Macedon both succeeded and failed to conquer Armenia during Alexander's lifetime. Personally, I think the solution here is kind of obvious. They did not conquer all of Armenia for any extended period of time, and the Orontid family continued to fight against the Macedonian occupation. Eventually, Orontes II died and passed the reins to his son. Traditionally, this is identified as Mithrenes, an Iranian commander who went over to Alexander. Different interpretations of a damaged section of the family genealogy can go either way on this. It's equally possible that Mithrenes was confused with Mithraustes, an Armenian co-commander with Orontes II mentioned by Arrian. Or an entirely distinct Mithra something-ese, as is often the case in late Achaemenid history. The important thing is that after Eumenes left Armenia during the Second War of the Diadochoi, the province was largely ignored by the other successors, allowing Orontes III, a grandson of Orontes II, to establish himself as an independent king and begin forming separate alliances with the other successor states. We really don't know much about what was actually going on in Armenia under Orontes III, but its internal politics were very complex in the 3rd century. The core area from Lake Van to the Black Sea, and bordering with the other new kingdoms emerging in the Caucasus, is generally what we call Greater Armenia. But something worth understanding is that all of these little kingdoms, especially in Anatolia and the Caucasus, had their own politics with one another. As they come in and out of the history of Persia narrative, there will sometimes be unexplainable shifts in the borders of these little kingdoms. That is because they were fighting each other, not just sitting around and waiting for the bigger empires to make a move. Especially during this early period, when the post-Diadochoi borders were still being decided, they were all competing and fighting over territory. And Armenia rapidly expanded through the former provinces of Cappadocia to seize control of the regions of Sophene and Comagene. Whether that happened under Orontes III or his son Sames is hard to tell, but these regions were sort of part of Armenia and sort of their own thing, possibly used as regions for younger members of the Orontid family to rule as vassal kings and avoid conflict with their fathers or brothers. So Sophene, Comagene, and a number of other Armenian border regions are not independent yet, but they are semi-autonomous. Just because all of those names will mean something to some listeners, keep that detail in mind for the time being. Finally, we turn to the south and to a corner of the empire where we really haven't spent much time. Arabia. Trying to follow Arab history prior to Islam can be a nightmare, because we are often reliant on later Muslim scholars who try to flatten out their own people's histories into a more understandable and religiously orthodox narrative, or Greek and Roman historians who also tried to flatten the narrative and just didn't have a great understanding of Arab politics or culture to begin with. I am also going to do a little bit of that because it's hard to avoid at this point, and we are just summarizing today. First thing to understand, at this point in history, Arab does not always mean Arabic speaking. It broadly refers to all of the semi-nomadic and Bedouin peoples of the southwestern Seleucid Empire, regardless of language, and included large swaths of modern Syria, Iraq, and Jordan in addition to the Arabian Peninsula. Many of these people were Arabic speakers, but it occasionally also includes Aramaeans and other languages that have died out over time. Arabs first start appearing in the historical records of the rest of West Asia during the Neo-Assyrian Empire, but they have generally been at the periphery up to this point. Occasionally, somebody in the Achaemenid Empire would employ Arabs in an army or a revolt, but they haven't been a major political actor in their own right. That is about to change in a big way. We don't even really have documentation for the exact process that caused it, but during the late Achaemenid and early Hellenistic periods, Arabs, both Aramaic and Arabic speakers, spread deeper through inner Syria and Mesopotamia than they ever had before, becoming an increasingly important part of the Seleucid cultural landscape. At the edges of the empire, two main groups of independent Arabs formed powerful political and military forces of their own. The Kedarites had long been the most powerful Arab force on the imperial fringe, controlling most of the deserts between Mesopotamia, Syria, the Levant, and Egypt. They were often vassals of the Achaemenids, and during the early Hellenistic period, their loyalties fluctuated between the Ptolemies and Seleucids as it suited them. More often than not, when we see Kedarites going forward, it will be as allies to one of the Hellenistic powers. The other Arab group to keep your eye on at this point is the Nabataeans. These were Arabic speakers who emerged as a powerful tribal confederation in northeast Arabia and modern Jordan in the late Achaemenid period. At this point, they were governed by a council of elders and exploited the power vacuums caused by the wars of the Diadochoi to cut a swath through what used to be Western Kedarite territory. They may even have started out as part of the Kedarite Confederation, but by the Third War of the Diadochoi, the Nabataeans and Kedarites were on opposite sides of the Antigonid Kingdom. The Nabataeans started raiding Diadochoi trade routes, attacking Antigonid merchants moving through Syria and Judea, and raiding Ptolemaic ships in the Red Sea. Antigonus Monophthalmos actually had to delay his war against Seleucus to fight the Nabataeans for control of the Dead Sea and Idumea, the southern desert of modern Israel known today as the Negev. Nabataean interference with Antigonid trade was probably a decisive factor in allowing Seleucus to remain in control of Babylon, and eventually become the dominant force in West Asia. As with so many of our minor kingdoms today, the collapse of Antigonid power after the Battle of Ipsus, and the increasing focus of the remaining Diadochoi on European affairs, both created an opening and an opportunity to get with the new program. At some point in the early 3rd century BC, the Nabataeans shifted away from their ruling council to a more centralized monarchy. They were also able to push further north along the Jordan River, exploiting the border dispute between Seleucus and Ptolemy to secure more territory of their own, as far north as Basra in southern Syria. Basra is home to the oldest known inscription referencing a Nabataean king, and although his name is lost on the inscription, later records identify kings named Rabel and Malichus in this period. Which came first, or if there is a yet unknown Nabataean king before either of them, is anyone's guess. But around the time of Antiochus I, he had a growing Arab kingdom on his southwestern border. Though the Nabataeans were more territorial than the Kedarites, neither of these groups were really states in the traditional sense of holding geography and calling it their own. Especially in this early period, they controlled trade routes, not borders, and their territories routinely crossed over with one another. This will eventually lead to some very odd alliances of Arab kingdoms and confederacies with the settled powers to their north. But for now, that wraps up our little survey of the newly independent kingdoms on the Seleucid border. Next time, we resume the regular narrative with King Antiochus I. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.